This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Friday. Time for the Week in Review. And let's start with the more than two dozen New England bids to be the home for Amazon's HQ2. Here's Worcester's pitch.
Alexa, compose an email.
What's the message?
Hey, team. I think I found the city for our second home. Let me tell you about Worcester, Massachusetts.
And from the Merrimack Valley.
They don't make buildings like this anymore. Why? Because they have character, just like the Merrimack Valley.
I think I want to marry you.
There's our friendly neighbor to the north.
New Hampshire has all the benefits of Boston without the headaches, without the traffic, without the taxes, without the bureaucracy, but still being able to draw off the most talented workforce pool in the world.
Yeah. Well, Boston says,
we do not imitate, for we are a model to others.
The gratuitous John F. Kennedy tape there in the Boston pitch for Amazon's HQ2. So joining us to discuss the Week in Review is Tom Keene. He's Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Tom, it's good to see you again.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Tiziana Deering. She's co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's good to have you too.
Hi there.
I love all the bids. I'm not sure who I would pick if I were Jeff Bezos, but let me just start off with, this is inspired by what you asked me during the newscast break, Tom. If you had to make a call right now, who Amazon might pick, who would you pick?
So I think they would probably go up north to our neighbor in the north, Canada and Toronto.
I like that. That would be my call too. But why?
I think geographic diversity and genuinely national diversity. I think Toronto is a great city, beautiful architecture. It probably has a great pool of smart workers. And it avoids sort of the problem of having to pick among the United States and get all of the other cities jealous.
Mad at you. Tiziana, you had an interesting thought about Toronto, too.
Well, I guess my thought with Toronto is that one thing you don't have to do there is worry about visas and bringing in workers from other countries the way you do now in the United States. And why, if you've got a growing tech industry business, why would you pick a place that gives you that headache?
Yeah, it's currently less politically fraught, for sure. Okay, so Toronto gets 3 votes from this Boston crowd here. But let's talk about the New England pitches a little bit, and actually also how all this has come about. I mean, what do you guys make of the fact that we have more than two dozen bids coming from New England? I mean, that's a lot. Is it a signal of regional strength or kind of a scattershot approach to bringing a major company to the region? Tom?
It seems to me it signals a regional weakness, not a strength. This is actually our problem, which is that we've got all these individual little cities and towns, no regional government or anything like that. And so everyone goes off scattershot. You can see that in our development in general. You can see that in our approach to this. And by the way, it's contrary to what Amazon asked for, which is somewhat of a unified bidding approach.
Oh, okay. Interesting. We've done exactly the opposite.
Right.
Tiziana?
Well, I want to start by saying that I don't watch The Bachelorette on purpose. And so having to just participate in this reality show parade. It's driving me a little nutty in the first place. But in addition to that, I actually see it as appropriate and a strength because at the end of the day, A, Amazon probably has a pretty good sense of what they want. B, they're not going to either say, oh, wow, I couldn't see the Merrimack Valley because we just only saw a proposal from Boston, or that's it, you didn't comply with the rules. Boston was actually our first choice, but since Massachusetts submitted the Merrimack Valley as well, we're out of here. I mean, none of that's going to happen. So if you've got different regions that want to make different cases, why not allow them to do that and see if Amazon bites? My guess is they have a short list already anyway. They're just using this as competition to try to sweeten
the pot. Well, exactly. So let's talk about that for a little bit because, I don't know, maybe I'm not smart enough to fully understand this process, but I really want to know why Amazon is even doing it this way. I mean, it's a huge company. They've got massive resources. They could, even if they wanted to put people on the ground in all 50 states to find out the locations that were best for them, they could do that. Is this really just one of those giant races to the bottom, Tom?
No, I think it's actually a really smart thing on Amazon's part because what Amazon has done, if they pick someone first, then that person all of a sudden thinks they have to be wooed and can now demand more and more out of Amazon. Here, it's the opposite way. The cities are trying to woo Amazon, and they're coming up with, in Worcester's case, lots and lots of financial incentives. And Amazon's got to be delighted.
But that's
to
the
see
race
stuff
to the
like
bottom
that.
Part, though, isn't it?
Oh, well, it's the race to the bottom in terms of the cities and towns. Yeah. But from Amazon's point of view, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Tiziana, your thoughts?
Well, takes me back to
The Bachelorette. Exactly.
Yeah. It does feel like a race to the bottom. And, you know, the other thing that drives me nuts about this, and we've seen this in lots of other examples, anytime you get into a situation where you're competing for association with a for-profit company, the value that anything other than the for-profit company brings to the table is devalued. Right? Mm-hmm. The value of our roads and bridges, of our talent pool, of our infrastructure, of our corporate and business culture here, of our civic engagement, et cetera. So you wind up racing to the bottom to try to bring a corporation in, which devalues all of the assets that you're bringing to the table. I think Tom's right that from Amazon's perspective, this is a smart way to go. But from a city and town's perspective, it actually doesn't then allow you to come to the table as an equal partner and say, let's talk about what's mutual.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I'm not sure. I agree with that.
Yeah, and actually, I want to give some kudos to Boston at this point, because I actually thought Boston's proposal was really not a race to the bottom. We didn't go out there offering tons of money. We went out there selling ourselves, talking about the educated workforce, sort of talking a little bit over the transportation system and the cost of housing. Yep. But it really was a really well-constructed proposal that was trying to be somewhat co-equals with Amazon.
Well, to that point, let's hear a little bit from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. We talked with him here on Radio Boston on Wednesday. That's when he gave me that wink about wink, wink, Suffolk Downs, East Boston. And we spoke with him before the bid was actually made public, which it was today. And here's what he said about why Boston's current bid, underscore the word current, does not include any tax incentives.
We didn't put any tax incentives in this piece right now. I mean, some cities did. There was one in Massachusetts that put a $500 million incentive.
Worcester.
Yeah, it's too early in the process. You just don't know what exactly it is that you're building yet. So we'll get a chance now, if we get to the next round, to see what cities were chosen, what their bids were like, and to see really what we're up against.
So interesting and smart response there, because the mayor's also saying he's open to actually doing tax incentives, doing bidding if Boston gets through to later rounds. He's obviously done that before with GE. Tiziana.
Well, yes. And I do agree that the mayor tried to come as equal a partner as possible, except that he did leave the door open. And we all know that if there is a second round, there will be discussions about tax incentives. I find that particularly ironic, given what we've heard about GE in the last 24 to 48 hours and the strains that company is under and the concerns that it raises about the long-term return on investment for the tax breaks and other incentives given to them to come here. I guess at the end of the day, it does make sense to do smart math, and where there are smart trade-offs, one should make them. And if tax incentives is a part of that, so be it. But there is a dynamic in this situation that feels a little more coercive than I think would be ideal for all of the parties involved.
Okay, so let me just jump in here, because this takes me back to the other thing, which I was like, it's not often that I disagree with Tiziana, but I do hear a little bit. Because, okay, Boston aside, because it's kind of a unique entity in New England, but, you know, I think it actually may be worth it for New Bedford, Fall River, Worcester to do what they can to get a giant company and the 50,000 jobs that would come with it. You know, imagine what that would mean for Worcester. So maybe offering the most competitive tax incentives they can is a good idea.
So I'm not sure I buy off on that. I think what happens is when you start off, when the foot forward is tax incentives, you're really saying you don't have a lot else to offer. And Boston, I think, was really saying we have a lot to offer. And if at the end of the day it's some money to get us over the line, yeah, we can talk about that. But that's not why a company, quite frankly, is going to move
to
any location.
Exactly,
in the long run, this is going to be trivial stuff. What they're really going to care about is the workforce and about the environment that's going to be there. I do think in terms of all the other places that put their foot out for Amazon, I can't believe that the Merrimack Valley, for example, really thinks it's going to get Amazon and the second headquarters.
Oh, we ought to be hearing from this. Send me a tweet at Radio Boston, guys.
But I don't think it's a worthless exercise, because Amazon continues to expand. And by making their name known and by saying, hey, you know, maybe this is a distribution center or some other satellite office, They're part of that mix.
Okay,
yeah, and what I do like about that piece of it is not just Amazon, but everything from, you know, the Worcester bid, the Fall River, New Bedford bid, all the way out to the Grand Rapids, Michigan bid. What it does do is tell other businesses of a smaller scale, but who may also be looking for a new place to be, about all these other American communities that have some ability to really support great industry and innovation. Mm-hmm. And I do like that part of it.
So we here at Radio Boston are obsessed with comparisons and comparing hypotheses to known data sets. And there's one known data set in terms of what is it like to have Amazon in your city, and that is in Seattle. So we actually also this week spoke with two long-term Seattle journalists about how much Amazon has changed the city of Seattle, which it has a lot. There's more than 40,000 people who work in downtown Seattle because of Amazon alone. They're the single largest owner of high-end office space in the city, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one of those folks that we talked to is Joni Balter. She's a longtime Seattle reporter. And the effect of Amazon in Seattle, here's how she said some Seattleites describe it.
Amageddon is one word that we use for it.
Amageddon, she said, because the changes have been so big. And on the one hand, yes, city coffers are full, she says. They got a lot of money. But on the other hand, housing crisis, horrible traffic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Joni then also told us, I said, hey, you know, for the cities and towns out here that want to are vying for Amazon, what piece of advice would you give us? And she said this.
Joni, what do you wish for?
What do you wish for?
And be careful what you wish for.
So the what do you wish for part was interesting to me, because I wonder if like the finalist cities will be gutsy enough to say, hey, Amazon, actually what we really want is we want a commitment for you to build 50,000 units of housing for us.
Right. And I think the problem that the city that gets Amazon is going to find is that it will almost certainly be the largest employer and, just like in Seattle, own the most real estate. And as a consequence, will be in a position to be able to really negotiate hard with that particular city. And then there's something else for cities to think about. It's a competitive marketplace out there. Yeah, Amazon's huge right now, but we're in a world of technological change where, you know, the big companies of today may be gone 3-5 years from now, and you really don't know what's going to happen with Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in a Midwestern town where there was one big corporate employer. Mm-hmm. And during my childhood, that employer threatened to move their headquarters if the city didn't actually annex several other townships and do some other pretty extreme things that the people didn't want, but that the corporation did want. And I think I've been affected by that in my life, by seeing once a large corporation comes in, it is really important to develop a sense of shared vision, shared planning, shared objectives, shared investment, because otherwise the leverage is so tremendous that a town or a city can be somewhat consumed by the corporate agenda if there isn't some balance in that relationship.
Right.
And when there is, it can actually be very positive for all the parties involved.
Right.
We don't want to become Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Oh, good point, both of you. Okay, well, we could talk about Amazon forever, but let's not. Let's instead move on to the fact that we just have a couple of weeks to go until Election Day. So it means it's the final stretch of the race for mayor for the city of Boston. This week here on Radio Boston, we talked with both Boston Mayor Marty Walsh for an hour and City Councilor Tito Jackson for an hour as well. And there were some fireworks, I have to say. Tito Jackson just yesterday came on and he told us that he was very unhappy that there haven't been that many debates in this mayoral race. Thus far, there's only been one, actually. And Councillor Jackson told us he had a problem with that.
This is voter suppression. And I want to be
suppression.
It is suppression.
How is it voter suppression for the mayor to not debate
the engagement? And I have to say this, the engagement that is needed for people in the city of Boston, I believe, has suppressed, and it's the reason why we only saw 50,000 people come out in a major American city on September 26th. That's real.
And September 26th was the day of the preliminary election. Tom Keene, your thoughts.
So suppression is such a loaded word, and clearly Tito should never have gone in that direction.
But he was trying to make a deeper point.
He was trying to make a deeper point, but two observations. First of all, the voter turnout that you had for this election was kind of similar to the voter turnout you have in a lot of preliminary elections in Boston where there isn't really a lot of fireworks going on, and that's what was going on in this case, including if you go back and look at some of the preliminary elections under Tom Menino. That's point one. Point two, it's not the other candidate's job to get your voters out for you. It's not Marty Walsh's job to get Tito Jackson's voters out for him. That, if Tito can't get them out, then that lays, that's his fault, not Marty Walsh's.
But what, okay, so, but Tiziana, Tom makes good points. And in fact, that was some part of my pushback for Councillor Jackson yesterday. I said there has to be some responsibility on the part of voters to want to engage in the democratic process. But on the other hand, to his, the councillor's deeper point, look, I'm throwing both my hands up. I'm in the media. Of course I want as many debates as possible. And we haven't had a lot. We've had one. There's one next week. I mean, is the councillor not right to be raising the alarm here?
Well, I think I would like to separate those two things. Okay. If there is a concern that there's not enough discussion about real issues that affect voters going on and that we haven't come up with sufficient mechanisms to do that, yes, I think the more we get issues discussed, the better for the city. Contested, truly contested elections are good for everyone who runs and for everyone in the community. And so to the extent that the councilman may be feeling frustrated that this doesn't really feel like a contested election, I certainly understand that. Debates are one mechanism. They're one vehicle. There are many vehicles to contest an election and raise issues. And from an instrumental perspective, what's in it for Mayor Walsh to do more debates? I mean, it would be very hard to bring him to the table to do that. He's not behaving exceptionally here. Anywhere that you see big polling differences in a candidate, an incumbent who's dramatically in the lead, usually they try to have as few debates as possible.
Right. Okay, so to that point, I think we had an example when I talked with the mayor on Wednesday, and I talked with Councillor Jackson just yesterday on Thursday. But we saw on Wednesday with Mayor Marty Walsh maybe why he doesn't want to participate in that many debates. And there was a moment where we were talking about policing in Boston, and I asked him a question that came in from a listener. We have another question that came through online from Alex, who asks, why haven't you responded yet to the policing questionnaire put out by the ACLU, Digital Fourth, and other civil liberties organizations?
I have no idea. I'll have to check and see.
Your campaign manager sent a letter back to the ACLU saying that you wouldn't respond.
Oh, I don't even know. I don't even know about that. Okay. It might have been based on, and let me think, are we taking another break here?
We're going to take a break in about a minute.
I'll find out after that, and I'll comment after the break.
So the mayor did find out, he called his campaign and found out why they didn't sign or fill out the ACLU's policing questionnaire. And he said when we came back after the break, he said it's because they didn't feel like they had to. A lot of the questions were already, in the mayor's word, slanted towards his administration's policy on policing. And then I said, well, okay, well, why don't you answer them now? And I asked him one of those questions. Some of them are yes-no questions. I've got some of them right here in front of me. Do you want to answer them?
No, I'm not going to answer right now.
Why not?
Because there's other questions we didn't do.
But why? I mean, but it's just they're yes-no questions about policing.
Give it to me.
Okay, I'll give you. They're not hard. If reelected mayor of Boston, will you prevent the Boston Police Department from obtaining military weaponry such as machine guns, armored vehicles, drones, bayonets, or grenade launchers from the U.S. military?
Yeah,
yes or no?
We've been very clear on that all along. I actually made a public statement against that, and I thought that I criticized other police departments around the country for doing that.
Okay, and then the mayor went on, and I asked him three or four of the other of the ACLU's questions, and he answered them all in good faith. But the reason why we wanted to play all that back is that is the kind of stuff that should be happening in a debate. And I think people ought to be hearing what both candidates' policies are on important things like policing. And we haven't had that much of that kind of discussion in this race, Tom.
No, and we clearly have not. And as a general proposition, you're absolutely right, which is that if we had two relatively evenly matched candidates, you would be seeing a lot more of that kind of discussion. The problem here is that Marty Walsh is way ahead of his opponent. Tito has not been able to raise anything in the way of significant campaign cash to be able to mount a very effective campaign. And even in his district, he ended up losing to Marty Walsh in the preliminary election. Walsh is feeling very confident. At this point, he does kind of a Rose Garden strategy. He's just not going to rock the boat at all. He doesn't want to. Every debate is an opportunity for him to get tripped up. So he doesn't want to participate in debates. Every questionnaire is an opportunity for him to be nailed on a point he'd just as soon not answer.
Do you know what this makes me think of? That the bigger issue here is one that Boston has had for a long time, and that's the depth and breadth of its pool of potential of folks who could rise to be not. And this is no slant against Councillor Jackson at all. I'm thinking more broadly. Like, why don't we have more competitive races in the city? Is what I'm asking.
Yeah. I don't think the answer is the pool of candidates.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the nature of local politics and a few things that have gone on with the mayor and what a mayor is today. First of all, the role is largely administrative. And as a consequence, if you can keep the streets clean and plowed and so on, you're going to be okay and people really don't have a hook to go after you. The second thing is it's really tough in a local election to be able to raise campaign cash.
Yeah.
The people who contribute are typically people with business before the city. And the one thing, and their contributions are public information. So the last thing they're going to do is go up and give money to a challenger and find themselves ultimately frozen out when the incumbent wins yet again.
The Globe's done some good reporting on this, yeah.
Yes, and therefore, people who serve as the mayor of this city would have to change the behavior of the last 70 years, which is to not freeze people out when they challenge a sitting mayor, because they'd have to value contested elections that then raise the kinds of issues and bring forward the kinds of questions that you just brought forward. And it's not going to happen. And so it does create this incredible pressure to just maintain the status quo.
Yeah. Well, in the interim, this table and these microphones are always open to the candidates. They can come lock horns with me anytime. I'm not sure if that's good for the city's democratic processes as a whole. But anyway, so we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to above the fold, as they say over in the newspaper world, but are worth a mention anyway. So, Tiziana, you go first. Your hubbub.
Well, it's been a week where we've talked about women's empowerment very much. And just for the record, hashtag me too. By the way. But in the process, there's been another conference that's been happening this week that was hosted by Mothers for Justice and Equality, which is an organization that brings together women who have lost their sons to violence on the streets and work on social change and advocacy today. They have brought together people from all over the country who are working on these issues, who have experienced loss and taken that loss and turned it into solidarity and social action. And in today's environment, I just think it is the coolest thing that as we're here doing this, they're in Boston doing that and bringing those kinds of voices together in such a positive, productive way.
Absolutely. That's a great hubbub. Thank
you
for that.
Yeah.
Tom Keene.
So the internet nearly broke this week over a photo of a Bridgewater teacher dressed in 17th century garb, surrounded by two white children, holding a leash to a black child kneeling on the floor. The echoes of slavery were unmistakable, and people were outraged, and justifiably so, except for this. The woman wasn't a teacher, but rather a reenactor from Plymouth Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene depicted was a custom from back in those days of teaching toddlers to walk while holding them to a tether. The black child had volunteered to pretend to be the toddler. And similar photos involving white children pretending to be part of such a family scene are readily found. So what should the adults here have actually done? Should they have refused to allow the black child to pretend to be a toddler? That would have ensured this controversy never arose, thereby protecting the adults from criticism. But the kid would also have learned a lesson, that because of his skin color, he can't play the same games as his white peers. That, I think, would have been worse. I get that these are racially fraught times, but it's worth considering that before we jump to condemn, we pause to try and listen and understand.
Okay, this is a really good hubbub, too, but I have a solution. Don't put the picture on the internet.
That's
the most obvious one, but it's the one that I think people think of last/ they don't.
Right.
Right? Because you're right. It took a perfectly innocent educational moment and turned it into something that it didn't need to be. And I mean, the internet. Okay. So good. Excellent. I love that hubbub. But don't put it on the internet, people. Just don't.
Because everything's out of context.
Okay.
Right.
So, but my hubbub also is internet-based, social media-based, much, much, much lighter. Okay. This is a tweet that is in the process of breaking Twitter, like right now, real time, before our very eyes. And it's like the best thing I've seen in all month. It comes from someone who calls himself on Twitter Edge, and Edge only has 1,090 followers. Edge is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And Edge tweeted this just yesterday, Dot at KFC, so the Twitter for Kentucky Fried Chicken or KFC, follows 11 people. Those 11 people, 5 Spice Girls and 6 guys named Herb. 11 herbs and spices. I need time to process this. And I checked, and indeed, KFC only follows 11.
It's
Jerry Horner, Melanie Brown, Mel C, Victoria Beckham, Herb Scribner, Herb Dean, Herb Waters, Herb Alpert. absolutely 11 Herbs and Spices, best tweet ever. Whoever works for KFC social media deserves a raise,
brilliant,
a promotion.
Brilliant.
This tweet right now, 248,583 retweets, 547,512 likes. Oh my God, the number just went up. 249,000 retweets. Edge, you knocked it out of the park. That is my hubbub for today, and I'm so glad to end on a little bit of good light news. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, it's always great to have you. Get better, okay?
I will, thank you.
And Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. Always great to have you, too.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.